Hi, welcome to Gorgeous Lives. Have you ever dreamed of becoming a model? Have you ever fantasized about going out with a rock star? Or have you ever wanted to be a businesswoman? Let's meet Jo Wood. She's done all of these things. So I'm here primarily to talk about your biography. Hey Jo, welcome to Radio Gorgeous.
Oh, Radio Gorgeous. I think it's a great name.
So you've had such a colourful roller coaster of a life, which is all disclosed in this new book. Yeah. What's charming about the book is that I've never met you before, but I heard your voice. You know, it came really strongly through and you just seem so down to earth and funny. Would you say that's a good description?
Yeah, that's me. Down to earth and funny. Yeah, I think that is me. What you see is what you get.
So you love dressing up and lived in a fantasy world as a child.
Yeah, I used to like dressing up as all sorts of things, actually. Always loved to dress up as a fairy. It actually went right the way through my life. I loved fancy dress parties. And my mum made me this really great fancy dress outfit once. I was a Fife's banana.
That is so good.
It was made out of, what do they call that paper that you used to see a lot? Raffia paper?
Yeah.
And Mum got them in sections and she sewed it all together with wallpaper lining paper underneath and made this banana shape. And Dad painted the Fife sign and I had my eyes stick, you know, little face bit here and hands sticking out.
That sounds
I was
so
the only
brilliant.
One that was a banana. At the party.
I hope you won the prize.
Yeah, I think I did, actually. And then I used to dress up on tour a lot. And once dressed up as a really old lady. Went down to Keith's room and security wouldn't let me in. I said, it's me, it's Joe, it's me, let me in.
So in your teens, you discovered Twiggy and that changed your life, really.
Yeah, I was absolutely obsessed with her. And I actually know her now. You know, it's like she's my hero. Very excited always to see her, but because she's a friend now. It was her and Barbara Hulanicki, who started Bieber, who are my, like, heroes.
You went to a party and met the love of your life, Ronnie Wood.
Yeah.
Who is the lead guitarist of the Rolling Stones.
I fell for him, actually, and was with him for a long time.
It took you a while to fall for him.
He was a bit blasé, you see. He was a bit... He thought himself so wonderful. He showed me a picture of himself on the album cover, and I thought, oh, God, how boring is this? And he started looking for me. What happened was, showed me the picture. He was all flash and said, what do you do for a living? And I said, I work in Woolworths on the broken biscuit counter. So he went there. I told him Main Branch in Oxford Street. Never been there in my life. I mean, the reason Woolworths was like came about is because my dad used to say, if you don't work hard at school, you'll end up in Woolworths. Anyway, he went there, and of course I was not there, and he waited outside all afternoon. And then he went back to the house where this party was, and my friend said, somebody see you in the other room? And it was him. You don't work in Woolworths, he said, because I've just spent the whole afternoon waiting outside. Strike one for Joe. Joe Wood loves Radio Gorgeous. I could drink any man under the table and I could do as many drugs as they did. But I mean, I didn't like anything. Like, I never really was into doing that heroin. I liked the speedy kind of things.
It held up the partying, basically, didn't it?
Yeah, and you know, it helped you with your drinking. You know, it kept you a bit sort of balanced,
I suppose. Exactly.
Not that I would recommend it, but, you know, it did. It wasn't good for me. It's not good for anybody. But you get caught up in it, and it's hard to break away. And it wasn't till a girlfriend came over and said, Joe, you haven't hardly left the house in a year. And you've not even gone out and bought yourself one item of clothing in a year. And then that really was what made me go, gosh, I haven't gone out and bought myself anything to wear. I looked at my kids and I thought, I need to get myself together. And I stopped.
Radio Gorgeous, the sexist station where you'll only hear the female voice. And then your relationship finally ended with Ronnie. And you've been with him how many years, would you say?
33.
That is... at least a third or half of your life. I mean...
Yeah, it was a lot of my life. After 4.5 years, I love being on my own. I love that, being on my own and doing what I want in my house and just pottering around. Yeah, I don't experience that loneliness anymore. So for anybody who's listening to this that's at that lonely point, it does change. And then Strictly came along. I thought, woohoo, here we go. I'm going to do Strictly. Not that I even knew I could even dance, which I couldn't. And then I started going out. And then I went to the opening of an envelope. Everything I could go to, I went to. I went out clubbing. I met a great friend, Michael, and he took me out everywhere. We'd go and have breakfast at 4 o'clock in the morning in Soho. And I went mad for a year. I felt like nothing by the time Ronnie left. And I think the more times that then you don't trust him and he's disappearing here and it just breaks you down. My life has made me the woman I am today. So there's nothing I'd change.
This is a Radio Gorgeous production.
So you're a think tank report writer.
I do investigations for a right of centre think tank called the Centre for Policy Studies. And I also write comment pieces for the Daily Mail and the Sunday Times.
Tell us how you came to be friends with Swagger and then meet this gang of teenage boys.
Well, I was doing this report on why black Caribbean and white working class boys fail. Wanted to come down to Brixton and interview some black gangs. And I met Swagger at a community centre. And he said, you really don't think it's a good idea if you wander around South London picking up black teenagers. So he said, I'll come with you. So we had a great day, just really going around picking up boys. And then towards the end, he said, you know, there's this gang that always hang around outside my local chicken takeaway. You know, let's go and talk to them. Frankly, they looked terrifying. They were about 15 or 16. Their jeans were hanging down. They wore hoodies. They were shouting. They were aggressive. They were sort of bumping into passers-by, catching cigarettes. And they looked capable of anything. I mean, I'm sure that they had a knife or a gun or something. As a sort of white, middle-class, middle-aged woman, I mean, all I wanted to do was just, go on walking down my side of the street and not draw attention to myself. Anyway, I followed Swagger and started talking to them, and it was really the best thing I've ever done. I was just charmed. They were intelligent. They thought a lot about things that really we take for granted. I mean, something like love, family, and a future were not a given in their lives. Swagger had to sort of do a translation job between, because they didn't understand me. So, he was doing this translation job, but I was really surprised and moved by them. So I went back with Swagger. Tuggy Tug came bounding up the road. He's terribly pleased to see us, so that surprised me. And then I said, well, what have you been doing? They said, ooh, we've been doing the shooting and the stabbing, and they were sort of hunching up their shoulders and look aggressive. But I have to say, I have a teenage son who was their age, and I know that my teenage sons are always very hungry at that point, and I thought they looked a bit peaky. So I said, are you hungry? And immediately all the bravado vanished. And they said, oh, we're always hungry. He chose two friends who much later on I discovered he charged £5 each, for including. He's a great entrepreneur.
He really is.
And I took them off to Nando's. And then they immediately opened up. They told me a lot about their life. And I was really quite shocked and upset about what was happening to them. And I was not expecting that 15-year-old boys in this country would be hungry. Tuggy Tug was actually in care. Two of them are from the care system. And I wasn't expecting that they would be just sort of abandoned in this awful hostels with sort of ex-murderers and drug dealers and everyone else living in the same place. No cooking facilities, no money, and just left to get on with it on something like, I think it's about £45 a week. But, how many of us sort of middle-class parents would leave our 15 or 16-year-olds in a hostel on their own, expect them to get up at the right time in the morning, make their own breakfast, get themselves to school every day, buy their food on the way home, make themselves dinner, put themselves to bed at the right time. You know, if a whole lot of friends turn up, say, no, I can't come and party tonight, I've got to do my homework. I don't think any of us would. I soon discovered, as you know, as the years went by, the one thing I had in my favour, it was that I was a fixture in their lives. That was so extraordinary.
The drug dealing is very, very compelling. It doesn't affect their benefits. You have prestige. You have money. It breaks up the monotony of their lives.
That's so true. I mean, one of the things I realised is how bored they are. These boys are seriously bored. They are hanging around on a street corner. I mean, they are so bored that when a middle-aged white woman like me comes along, hey, I say, you know, come and see the Imperial War Museum. They've never been to a museum. And they are so bored that they will come. Well, I think any mother of a 15-year-old boy will appreciate how extraordinary that is.
Radio Gorgeous supports women. Women support Radio Gorgeous.
I mean, how is this affecting your life?
It's making me very angry. I actually became completely obsessed. I mean, my friends got really bored. Every article I wrote was, you know, saying, this is what's going on. And I got really, really angry about what was happening to these boys.
The violence erupted a couple of summers ago. What did it make you think?
I'm all taking part, you know, and I'm sort of ringing them up and saying, what are you doing? No, you cannot go in there. Get back home.
Get out there. Put that merchandise down. This instant.
But the interesting thing was that I remember talking to Matt, and he was just standing outside, and he was not running in to go and pick the trainers up. What was fascinating, he more amazing than the looting, was the fact, he said, you know, people like me, you know, we were all locked in our houses, not going out. But for him, it was the opposite. This was the first day he could move freely round his own city.
I'm here with Jodie Day, who's the founder and creator of Gateway Women, whose motto is, we may not be mothers, but we are here, we care, we count, and we rock. I love you, Jodie.
Thank you for that introduction. It's great to be here.
Why are women childless more and more?
Well, I think it's important, first of all, to make a distinction between childless and child-free. And child-free is childless by choice. Mm-hmm. And that is also on the rise. And the problem with statistics is they don't actually show how many women are childless by choice and how many women are childless by circumstance. The women that Gateway Women speaks to are the women who are childless by circumstance. That can be infertility, which is the one most people think of. But it's also, you know, you're married to someone who already has children, or you have a chronic condition, which means it's not a good idea, or increasingly something called social infertility, which is not finding a suitable partner during your fertile years to have a family with. So those factors are all influencing the rise in what we call involuntary childlessness, which doesn't sound very kind of interesting.
Tell me about you then. So you are a journalist and you are childless and you were married.
I was indeed. I married at 26. I thought I was incredibly grown up. but now when I meet 26-year-olds, I just think, I can't believe I was getting married then. Started trying to conceive when I was 29. Was completely confident that I would be able to have a child because I'd actually been pregnant at 20 and had an abortion. So I was pretty sure that, you know, everything worked. A couple of years later, still nothing happening, went to see the doctor. I ended up having a kind of exploratory operation just to check that everything was fine because I was nervous that maybe there'd been some damage. And my very avuncular gynaecologist surgeon said, as I came round from the anaesthetic, absolutely first-class property, ready to move into, finest uterus I've seen all week, go and have more sex. Which was pretty much all the advice I ever got from doctors.
Sounds fun.
Yes, my husband was fine with that. So, you know, I then went into kind of what I call baby mania, which is something which I think all women who've struggled to get pregnant will recognise, which is basically I might as well have just sort of walked randomly up and down Notting Hill and Harley Street throwing £50 notes through people's door. But, you know, I saw every acupuncturist, every vitamin specialist, every, you know, herbal person, all of the kind of the big names in sort of alternative, you know, helping you get pregnant. I never got pregnant. No one ever found out why. And I got pretty obsessed, you know. I mean, my fridge looked like a pharmacy. I was force feeding my husband vitamins. I peed on every type of stick you can imagine. And so by the time it was time to sort of do IVF, really, the marriage, I just realised I couldn't bring a baby into this. And
how old were you then?
I was 37 and we split up when I was 38. And I think pretty much fueled by baby mania, I got divorced very quickly and I threw myself out onto sort of the world of internet dating with unseemly haste. I was barking mad, to be honest. I had a sort of an epiphany. I was sort of standing in this rather grotty studio flat. It was a bed, it'd be called a bedsit, but in Notting Hill they call them studio flats. Yeah. And just sort of, it came to me sort of with a real thump, you know. I thought, you know, I'm 43 and a half. If I was to meet someone, I'd need to know them for at least a year before we could even consider IVF. I'll be 44 and a half. It's too late. And at that moment, that's when my 15-year kind of journey, my quest, my obsession to become a mother, you know, it kind of stopped at that point.
Was that like the lowest point?
No, it got lower. I have to say, that afternoon, it was quite interesting because I had a very strong physical reaction to that thought, which was I had the feeling that two parts of me that had been split for a very long time sort of came back together. The life path I'd been living, which was all about the day I was going to become a mother when everything was going to start, and the life path I was actually living, which they were in constant negotiation with each other. Well, I can't take this job because what if I get pregnant? But this one's got really good maternity leave. But I can't do that. But I can't be with him because he does this constant double track negotiation that was exhausting.
Yeah.
That stopped. And so I had this surge of energy. And about 10 minutes later, I was making a cup of tea and I thought to myself, well, when I was 20 and I looked ahead to the years to 50, as old as I would ever be, yeah. And I thought, you know, I imagined I could do anything I wanted with my life. I mean, forgive me, I was 20, you know, I had that kind of confidence. And then I thought, well, why can't the years from 45 to 75 feel like that? You know, that's a good chunk of time to do something with if I'm not bringing up children. And then I thought, when was the last time I had a thought like that? Do you know what I mean? I hadn't had a thought about my future. It had always been, when I have a baby, then sort of something
like
started.
You were delaying your life.
Totally. It was on hold, completely on hold. I call it being in the tunnel. Just this absolute, you know, mono track. And very oppressive because, of course, as it gets less and less likely, it gets more and more panicky. Mm. You know, that was really when I came out of denial about the fact that I was now a childless woman. I wasn't someone who didn't have children who would one day be a mum. I was a childless woman. And really what that was the beginning, although I didn't understand what was going on, that was the beginning of my grieving.
Yes.
And I went downhill, really, you know, it was really, really hard. And I had a very dark period for a few years. I do remember one particular day, sort of lying on the floor, looking at the skirting board in my flat and thinking, I'll stand up when I can think of a compelling reason to do so.
Every fairy tale is about finding a man and having a family.
Indeed, and also the bad ladies in fairy tales are always childless. You know, Snow White's childless stepmother, Cruella de Vil, the witch in Narnia.
Yeah,
they're never mums. I'm going to be childless for the rest of my life.
Yeah. You've got to set yourself up now, as you say, for the next 30 or so years.
And deal with inane comments and a lack of understanding around how deep this issue is, particularly when you then hit the menopause as well. Yes. So it's like it's absolutely over. You know, the menopause for a childless by circumstance woman, it's a death you survive. It's like it's the end of your line. It's the end of the millions of years of genetic feats of survival that have got you here. It's over. And, but what Gateway Women also offers is a sense of community.
Thank you so much, Jude.
Thank you. It's lovely to meet a mum who gets it.
Welcome to Radio Gorgeous, women's voices on culture, style, society and well-being.
I'm here with Naomi Wolf, activist, author, I would say a warrior for the vagina. Something I just came up with as a reaction.
That's good.
To your book.
I'm a proud warrior for the vagina.
Fantastic.
That I like it.
Your book, Vagina, a New Biography, is coming out, and I mostly wanted to talk to you about that book.
Sure.
Which I also have to say, I hope I don't dissolve in tears because it had a very, very profound impact for me.
I'm so glad to hear that. Yeah. Would you tell me more? Because that's important to know.
I was raped, and I have worked really, really hard to have a happy sexual life, to have a close marriage, and I do have those things. But it struck me very, very deeply that there is still a wound there. Mm-hmm. And that as time goes on, I mean, I saw what it took from me in the immediate aftermath. Mm-hmm. And it took from parts of my life that you wouldn't think it would have hit in a physical way.
Yeah.
But I could very see that every aspect of my life was immediately affected.
Mm-hmm. It's very brave of you to talk about that and talk about it in the first person, and I hope more and more women will. You know, sadly, after I did all this work on the book, I also recovered memories. I actually was injured in the spring, and often an injury will trigger traumatic memory that has been suppressed. And so I hear you, and I too was raped in childhood and just suppressed it all these years. So you're absolutely right and very brave. And I really think like this is the next wave. It's part of why I wanted to write Vagina. If the things that happened just to one woman in the course of her life, positive and negative, she feels weird because they're so extreme. How is it possible that, you know, I've had this height of pleasure and I've had this terrible trauma? I don't mean me just alone. I mean, all of us. 30% of women have been molested or raped by a trusted male relative by the time they're 18. So a third of women are walking around with this very direct trauma. I would say it's like a defining event. I mean, I don't mean to startle you, and I don't mean to put it that reductively,
yeah.
But there was this study in Germany where they interviewed women who had been horribly traumatized in war, in other non-rape ways. Horribly, horribly, horribly traumatized. You know, whatever, beaten, abused, tortured. And women who'd been raped in exactly the same circumstances. And when the women who had been tortured were asked to recount their trauma, their cortisol levels in their saliva, which is a sign of stress, didn't rise in a specific way. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was, you know, very traumatic for them, obviously. Terrible, you know, injuries, terrible memories. But when the women, the control group, in exactly the same circumstances who had been raped, recounted their trauma, their cortisol levels in their saliva were much, much higher. And the speculation, which fascinated me, is that the reason the raped women had so much higher stress levels in remembering is that the enemy was more physically close to them. Like the person who could annihilate them, who was wiping them out as a human being, was inside of them, right? And so what that does to your animal, like I'm getting chills just saying that sentence.
And
I really want to stress that understanding the new neuroscience means that there's much better treatment that you can get. There's new trauma, not so new in places like Bellevue Hospital, where they've got a special program for trauma victims, but it's sort of trickling out, and part of my mission right now is to get the word out. And then I did this research on the brain-vagina connection, and that, you know, makes people very upset to say if they don't read the book and understand exactly what I'm talking about. But basically, and obviously there's a brain-penis connection too, you know.
We seem to have it intuitively with women, but in a negative context.
Interesting. What do you mean?
Oh, like she needs to, if someone's uptight, she needs to get laid.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Even verbal abuse.
Oh, my God, yes. Oh, like, the language in Britain, it's especially bad, but I have a section on the language that's used to talk about the vagina, you know, and it's so revolting. I don't even want to say the words, but, you know, if our daughters grow up not here, like in, you know, Han Dynasty China, it's Golden Lotus, Jade Gate, you know, Bower of Bliss, whatever. And, you know, in the 18th century, poets talked about, you know, the garland or the... And now it's just like, cunt, slid, and worse.
Yeah.
I mean,
far worse, yes.
Our 3-minute Western model of the porn shot is going to, by definition, leave 95% of women, even if they reach orgasm, unfulfilled.
And men,
right. But, you know, if you move to the tantric model of a much longer time period where we're going to spend stroking, touching, I'm not saying always, sometimes a quick fuck in the shower or whatever is... I really hope my kids never listen to this interview. You know, it's just what you want. But women have to know, they're wired to have to know that this is going to be part of their lives, you know, regularly, right?
Yeah.
Enough time, enough attention. Why is it more upsetting to talk about the divinity of female sexuality than the vulgar debasedness of it? I mean, I'm Jewish, so I'm lucky because we don't have an opposition between the mind and the body or the soul and the body within marriage in our tradition. Mm-hmm. Well, with women are given this false offer. You can either be an intellectual or you can be a sex pot.
This has been a Radio Gorgeous production for RadioGorgeous.com. And now over to our other interviewee, Sally Wainwright, the woman who created and is executive producer of Last Tango in Halifax. Sally Wainwright, welcome to Radio Gorgeous.
Hi.
So, Sally, Last Tango is inspired by your mum. Can you tell us about it?
My dad died in 2001, and my mum came to live with us down in Oxfordshire. And my sister put her on Friends Reunited to see if anybody she was at school with was out there, and there were two people from her class, and one of them was this guy called Alec Walker. It turned out he lived quite near. He lived in Northampton with his family, and he was widowed too. So they just got chatting, and he eventually asked if he could take her out for a cup of tea, and he came over to visit, and they just absolutely got on like a house on fire.
And did they fall in love?
Completely, absolutely. They were completely in love with each other. It was extraordinary. It was really uplifting. It was joyous. It was fantastic. It was wonderful. They were just so happy in each other's company.
So Last Tango in Halifax is set in Halifax. I've always been put off. I thought, oh, Halifax. But it looks stunning. It looks really pretty. Sorry, I'll be honest.
You snob.
Yeah. Because of the success of your programme, are more people visiting Halifax?
I think so. I think I saw somewhere where Halifax tourist industry had said that they'd certainly seen a bit of an increase recently.
What a thrill for you!
Hope
you get an award from the town.
Yeah.
So what's funny about the drama is that there's this charming old couple who have a tender and fun romance, and around them, their children's lives are completely collapsing. And that's where the comedy comes in, really, isn't it?
Well, it's where the drama comes in as well.
Yeah.
The great thing about Celia and Alan is that they kind of provide the magic for the series. People absolutely love watching Annie and Eric. It's wonderful.
Yeah.
They absolutely love each other off screen and on. But sadly, that doesn't make great drama. It's like Romeo and Juliet. Actually, them being in love is a bit boring.
Yeah.
What is interesting is the fact that their families hate each other.
Now, in Last Tango, you're dealing with unmarried mothers, lesbians, alcoholics, divorcing couples, children being damaged, jealousy, chippiness. How much fun as a writer is this?
It's brilliant. It's great fun. It's a really lovely series to write. The characters are so well-rounded, and because the actors give such extraordinary performances, I kind of feed off that. So the second series was even more delightful to write because I knew exactly who I was writing for. I knew what their strengths were. And it does tend to write itself, Last Tango. It's a bit of a gem.
Now, Anne Reed is the 70-year-old lead. She's fabulous. I adore the way she doesn't think before she speaks. And she's always carrying a copy of the Daily Mail.
Yeah, I saw some of the previews for last night's episode 3, and it said she's a gobby old cow and all this. And when I watched it, I thought she isn't.
No, she's great.
She says something that's a little bit indiscreet, and she says it very sensitively, and she really doesn't realise she's put a foot in it. I think Annie's fantastic at being able to put across characters who can be a bit flawed and can say the wrong thing, but you still really like it.
Yeah, and is it true, someone told me this morning, that there might be Last Tango in Halifax in the US?
Well, it's been transmitted in the US and it's done really well over there. There may be a US version, we're still negotiating at the minute.
Wouldn't that be hysterical? I wonder what town they'll use. It would be somewhere like Midwest or something.
I don't know. I'd be very excited to see it. I'd love to see what they make of it and how they do it differently through us.
You have so much going on, Sally. You are the most successful TV writer in Britain at the moment. How thrilling is it?
It's fun. It's fun. It's hard work, but it's great work. It's fun.
We know that you've got world peace, but what would you really like for Christmas, Sally?
If I've got world peace, I'd quite like a Bentley as well.
Yes! Well, I think it's on its way to you now, especially when you get the American rights. It's been so fabulous having you on Radio Gorgeous today. It's been a Radio Gorgeous production for Radio Gorgeous 2013.